From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, does our current approach to immigration enforcement make things even harder for victims of sex trafficking?
Perpetrators now know they don't have to use physical violence to force or coerce someone to work. In fact, the threat of deportation alone in this climate is enough.
Also today, President Trump is in Vietnam for his second summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un.
I think we'll have a very tremendous summit. We want denuclearization, and I think he'll have a country that will set a lot of records for speed in terms of an economy.
Wellesley Professor Kathy Moon will preview the historic gathering. And how a kid from Dorchester became a hometown hero.
I want people to keep going, because there's a way, dog. Like, if I could do it, anybody could do it.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. As more and more details emerge about Robert Kraft's alleged solicitation of prostitution, it's easy to see the case as tabloid fodder. But police say it's actually a window into the dark world of human trafficking, a world that is much bigger than any single person. And you don't have to go to Florida to see it. In fact, you don't even have to leave Massachusetts. WBUR's Shannon Dooling begins our show with this look at the scope of trafficking right here in Greater Boston.
A Beverly couple arrested for trafficking women for sex at a Salem brothel. A Lynn woman indicted for trafficking a minor from a Saugus group home. Two indicted for trafficking women for sex at Springfield massage parlors. Those are a few of the headlines coming out of State Attorney General Maura Healey's office over the last year, since Governor Deval Patrick signed the state's anti-trafficking law in 2011, more than 40 individuals have been charged in connection with trafficking crimes. My Life, My Choice is a Boston-based nonprofit that supports victims and survivors of sex trafficking. The group's Audrey Morrissey says a common public perception is that trafficking is more rampant among non-citizens. But she says young women and children born in the U.S. can be victims of trafficking, too. She says the two populations share distinct vulnerabilities.
Number one, poverty. When someone does not have resources that a lot of us take for granted, and someone promises a new way to live, right? A lot of disruption in the family could be what makes them vulnerable. They have no family.
Poverty, family upheaval, these are universal stressors that people who operate in human trafficking, both abroad and in Massachusetts, use to prey on their victims. Another tool? Fear, especially for those who have been trafficked from other countries.
I would definitely say that victims of human trafficking are the most frightened, the most vulnerable, the most underground of most of the crime victims that we work with.
Susan Church is a Boston-based immigration attorney. She says one of the most common fears among non-citizen victims is being deported. There are options for victims who are willing and able to come forward, Church says. The humanitarian T visa allows a victim of trafficking who cooperates with authorities to stay in the U.S. for several months and potentially apply for residency. The federal government issues a maximum of 5,000 T visas a year, a cap that's hardly ever reached. But after stories like that of Robert Kraft's alleged sex solicitation in Florida, Church says that might change.
I expect that in cases where high-profile trafficking cases hit the news, you will start to see lawyers screening better for T visa eligibility, and then you will see the cap reached.
At Boston University's Immigrants' Rights and Human Trafficking Program, Director Julie Dahlstrom says the clinic sees a range of clients and cases. Some include victims trafficked into massage parlors, like the one investigated in Kraft's case.
And I would say we see a variety of different kind of ethnicities, and this is not something that only impacts U.S. citizens or individuals who are, you know, from a particular community. Unfortunately, it is across the board.
We continue to have an increase in referrals.
That's Lisa Goldblatt-Grace. She's executive director of My Life, My Choice. And she's talking about an increase in referrals of young people who may be caught up in sexual exploitation.
Part of that is really the result of more and more folks are getting educated and are realizing that young person in front of them isn't a delinquent, but actually is a victim in need of support.
Goldblatt-Grace says on average, the young people referred to them for services are between 13 and 15 years old. She's hopeful that offering them support at a young age can help ease the transition out of sex work.
That report from WBUR's Shannon Dooling. And in Shannon's report, we heard from Boston University law professor Julie Dahlstrom. Again, she's the director of BU Law's Immigrants' Rights and Human Trafficking Program. We wanted to continue the conversation about the magnitude of the problem. The Florida investigation that ensnared Kraft involved multiple law enforcement agencies and spanned several months. So I began by asking Dahlstrom whether the kind of scale is typical in sex trafficking cases.
It's fairly common that investigations will involve multiple agencies and often multiple states. One thing that's interesting and a common misconception is that trafficking doesn't have to involve movement, but it's true that it does often span, you know, federal and state law enforcement because it can involve both state and federal crimes.
And we noted that the lead investigator in the Jupiter case in particular said he had been referred to the specific spa in Jupiter where they allegedly found Robert Kraft by an investigation happening in another jurisdiction. So this seemed to be a case where the probe just continued to get wider and wider the deeper they dug. Is that also typical?
You know, I think that it's very common. What we see nationally is that sex trafficking cases are often more investigated affirmatively in the sense of, you know, much of the information is available online because there are commercial sex ads and, in fact, also buyer review boards where buyers might even post about their experiences. So there's a plethora of information available online and many of these cases. So, in fact, investigators can move affirmatively and try to engage in these investigations, which are both time-intensive and also very complex.
Julie, what's the scope of the issue that we're talking about here? I mean, this seemed large on its face, and yet we're only talking about Florida. My understanding, as we've seen more and more reporting on this in recent days, is that this is a nationwide problem in all 50 states. Just how big is it?
You are indeed correct. This is unfortunately a problem in every state. You know, I think we've also had very recent comments from the president drawing attention to trafficking at the border. But in fact, this is a phenomenon that often does not involve the border, that involves U.S. citizens and non-citizens and occurs in all jurisdictions. The good news is we now have 50 states that have passed trafficking legislation. And so in many ways, there are the tools to combat the crime. But because of its underground nature, it still remains challenging to investigate and prosecute. And from my perspective, we represent survivors of trafficking. It also is increasingly challenging for survivors to receive much needed benefits like immigration protection or other types of benefits like victim compensation.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the border because the way the president has described the issue is perhaps one side of it. You know, he paints this picture of trucks trying to sneak across the border with women packed inside and their mouths duct taped. And that may be one aspect of it. But as we've learned more about this, we also understand that sometimes the women come to the U.S. Not in such sneaky terms, but perhaps they're lured here on the promise of a better life. Can you give us some insight into how that can work?
Yes, I think what's problematic about the president's rhetoric around trafficking are a number of things. First, you know, there's very much a conflation of what is trafficking and smuggling. Smuggling generally being a crime against the border that may involve, you know, moving individuals who are undocumented across the border. Trafficking really focusing on exploitation. And while those two things do sometimes occur together, they're often very disconnected. And in fact, you know, what we've represented non-citizens who are in the U.S. And undocumented, and because of certain vulnerabilities, may fall prey to perpetrators of trafficking. So it doesn't mean that you have to have been brought here for that purpose. And in fact, as I mentioned, many U.S. citizens also are survivors.
So on that note, in your research, do you find certain groups of people who are disproportionately affected? We know some immigrants. In fact, we've seen that. That appears to be the case here in Florida, but perhaps among the U.S. population, who is most likely to fall prey?
So I do think it's important not to overgeneralize, but there is research that has really looked at, especially U.S. citizens, and the connection between aging out of residential and foster care programs as creating vulnerability and a disparate impact on those who are in that age range of kind of 18 to 24. There's also connections between sort of victimization, poverty, and past histories of sexual abuse. Immigration status for non-citizens, I think, is both a particular vulnerability and has been more so given the current immigration climate, increased immigration enforcement efforts, and the fact that perpetrators now know they don't have to use physical violence to force or coerce someone to work. In fact, the threat of deportation alone in this climate is enough.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that stood out to me in our reporting here at WBUR was that there is a specific visa program available in some cases to women who are willing to cooperate in trafficking investigations, and the national cap is only 5,000, and it seldom is reached, which suggests that in a lot of cases these women are afraid to come forward and afraid to cooperate with authorities. Can you give us a sense of what resources are available to them, which perhaps in some cases aren't even being exercised because of the fear factor?
That's absolutely correct. So the good news is that there are special immigration benefits for survivors of trafficking, namely this T visa, and there are 5,000 available every year. And with that comes the right to remain, in some cases petition for family members and eventually have a pathway to residency here in the United States. There have been tremendous challenges in accessing those protections, one of which is that the requirement is to cooperate with law enforcement, although there are some limited exceptions. And as you can imagine, it can be very challenging for survivors to report to law enforcement when they may be fearful of reprisals from the perpetrators, or in this current climate, distrust law enforcement or think they may be connected to immigration. Now, while that's not always the case, it definitely the increased collaboration among law enforcement agencies has given rise to greater and greater fears. But I think the good news is that these benefits are still available. There are some current policies under this administration around referring denied cases to immigration court or removal proceedings, which are new and very disturbing. But we definitely still are representing clients who are having success in that process.
Well, Julie, is one of the trust issues with law enforcement there, too, that in a lot of cases, historically, we've treated prostitution as a crime and the women involved as criminals instead of victims. And do you see that changing at all?
I do see that changing. I think the good news is that in the greater Boston area and beyond, what we're seeing is that law enforcement increasingly are not arresting individuals for sex for fear-related charges. Also, in the last criminal justice reform bill that was passed this summer, there were provisions around vacating criminal offenses, for example, sex for fee for survivors of trafficking, which dovetails with national efforts to do this as well. So I do think that there is a growing movement in that direction, but there still needs to be further reform.
You know, Julie, I'm mindful that this is a longstanding, ongoing problem, and yet we're talking about it this week specifically because a high-profile figure was ensnared in the investigation. How would you like to see this conversation unfold? Are we doing this the right way in the press, in law enforcement, in society, when we talk about Robert Kraft in particular?
I think it is important and good news that there is greater attention to this issue. I hope that it will be prolonged, and I also hope that it leads to more nuanced discussions of this crime, rather than sort of simplistic narratives that don't help us create viable alternatives for both survivors and the general public.
That's Julie Dahlstrom, Boston University law professor and director of BU Law's Immigrants, Rights, and Human Trafficking Program. Julie, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
All right, we just heard a bit from Julie Dahlstrom about the role that law enforcement plays in combating human trafficking. For more on that, we turn to Carmen Ortiz, the former U.S. attorney from Massachusetts. She's now in private practice at Anderson & Krieger in Boston. Hi there, Carmen.
Hi, Callum. How are you?
I'm pretty well. I know that your office dealt with some trafficking cases during your time as U.S. attorney, so I'm hoping you can tell us a bit about what goes into this kind of work. I mean, how does law enforcement identify a ring, gather evidence, and then ultimately take it down?
Well, in many of these cases, either an agency will make a report of a girl that has come to them, an agency sort of, or an organization like My Life, My Choice. Someone will end up at a hospital. It'll be someone who's arrested in a particular area, complaints will be made about a particular location if they're trafficking women or having some kind of sexual activity in that location. And so the complaint will come in, and then there'll be an investigation that'll be conducted. If they think that there's a particular business, for example, that's being utilized as a massage or some kind of other, you know, the type of business where women are being sold for sex, then they can do an undercover operation. They can send someone in who can have a conversation with whoever is working at the place. And if there's a discussion about exchanging sex for money and being able to purchase it, that might suffice. But if you think it's a big operation, you can do an outside surveillance so that you see people coming in and out. And what you want is probable cause to be able to put in cameras and get a court order so that you can do basically what was done in the Florida massage parlor in the case, more recent case that has been highlighted in the media. You can show exactly that not only are they having conversations about paying money in exchange for sex, but then you can highlight the sexual activity. And that's really important where you're focusing and targeting the individuals who are the Johns, the purchasers of those services. Because if you're just focusing on who's running the business, if law enforcement goes in an undercover capacity and has a conversation where they're willing to take money and you exchange hands, money in exchange for sex, that might be sufficient. But typically for a trafficking case, you want to be able to show and have the cooperation of victims that are engaged in that kind of activity and use them to prosecute the perpetrators, which are really the targets at a federal level, more the people who are making the money and exploiting young women in this arena.
Well, so how hard, though, is it to get the cooperation of those women who are being trafficked, Carmen? Because I can imagine a lot of barriers. Some of them may not speak English. They may be afraid of the people who are controlling them. They may be afraid of deportation. I mean, can you speak to that challenge?
Absolutely. There's two areas here. You have the you know, women who come from foreign countries, and you're right, they don't speak the language, but you need to be able to try to break through to one. It could be one that's ended up in a hospital because she's been beaten up. It could be one that's been arrested. And the challenges are is to try to overcome, and you work with the victim witness advocates, social workers, law enforcement. You work with them to try to overcome the fear that they feel, because they have been, on many occasions, obviously, they've been exploited because they've been beaten. They've been exposed to violence. There's the sense of loyalty to the perpetrator. Some of these perpetrators provide with these young trafficking victims with the sense that that they love them, that they care for them, that they will take care of them. And so there's a degree of dependability. And so what law enforcement has to do is crack through those barriers, that fear and dependability, loyalty, and lack of trust of the government is also another arena that is a challenge for the government. And I think what happens is that you have to work with others in social services to help these victims overcome their fear and really try to provide them with support, a sense of safety, by putting them in a safe house, by providing them with fundings, and many of these you can, with women from particular who are illegal immigrants or who are fearing deportation. There are different mechanisms in the immigration laws. If they become a cooperating witness, there are different, there's a certain visa, I can't recall right now the type of visa, but there are ways that they can remain in this country as long as they testify and cooperate with the government. But law enforcement has to really work with a social agency and an organization to help these women be able to overcome their fears.
You know, Carmen, one of the things that stands out in the Florida investigation is that one of the alleged ringleaders is a woman named Lan Yun Ma, who was arrested in a similar case here in Oxford, Massachusetts, 7 years ago. It was a similar situation, smaller scale, but you had a massage parlor that was accused of trafficking and holding women in sexual servitude. Ma was initially charged with human trafficking in state court here, but she ultimately pleaded down to solicitation for prostitution, got a 30-day sentence, 3 years of probation, and now she's allegedly been able to pick up and move her operation to Florida. So how does that happen, Carmen? I mean, is that someone just sort of slipping through the judicial system? What goes wrong there where someone is allowed to allegedly reoffend?
Well, it's not that they're allowed to reoffend. It's that, you know, some of these penalties, depending upon how they're charged, for example, do not carry high penalties. Like you said, she was given 30 days. She paid a fine. She may have been on probation for a certain period of time, but then that probation ends, and they're free, really, to move around this country or elsewhere. So it's obvious that she's relocated to Florida and now engaging again in this business. It's very profitable. There were women that, though, are co-conspirators. For example, on the federal level, some of these are the individuals that are convicted don't really engage in this activity. Again, by the time the feds get in, there were a number of cases we did in which some of the traffickers received 20, 25-year, 30-year sentences. And these were individuals who, you know, were convicted of trafficking minors and engaging in tremendous violence, in attempts to kill other witnesses. And so the more egregious the conduct, the lengthier the sentence, and then they cannot reoffend. But someone like this who, especially for solicitation for prostitution, these are not serious sentences. And the folks that are prosecuted that have engaged in it, that have actually paid the money, many times there's no prison time or jail time. You just pay a fine, and the case is dismissed.
It is a really wide range, though. I mean, 30 years or 30 days. I mean, do prosecutors have the tools they need, Carmen, or do they sometimes feel like, you know, even if I bring down one of these rings, that people can kind of get away or get off relatively easy and then can continue to do their business somewhere else?
You know, it really depends on how big the ring is, how significant, what the evidence is. Have they really engaged in violent criminal activity? The more serious and egregious that the behavior is, the more serious the charges, and obviously the lengthier the sentence. If you get prosecuted on the state level, the sentences aren't so high, although I know that the sex trafficking, human trafficking statutes were amended a number of years ago here in Massachusetts, and I think there are stiffer penalties. But there's no question that the penalties at the federal level are more serious.
Well, you mentioning that toughening of the human trafficking law here in Massachusetts, and I'll just point out that Lan Yuan Ma was arrested and charged in Massachusetts before that law change went into effect. Carmen Ortiz, attorney for Anderson & Krieger and the former U.S. attorney for Massachusetts, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll preview the Trump-Kim summit in Vietnam. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Air Force One has landed, and President Trump is in Vietnam for his second summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Trump and Kim will meet tomorrow night, Hanoi time, for dinner, beginning one-on-one meetings and then expanded bilateral negotiations. The president is expected to push again for denuclearization, but what does that mean to the North Korean regime? Joining us now to preview the summit is Kathy Moon. She's a professor of political science and Asian studies at Wellesley College. Professor Moon, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, so this is the second summit between these two leaders. They met last summer in Singapore, of course. And afterward, President Trump declared, quote, there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. So could you remind us, Professor, what actually came out of that first meeting? I mean, was it really as productive as advertised?
Well, not according to objective standards. There was a lot of rhetoric that was exchanged between the two leaders in Singapore. The first thing, a commitment to denuclearization, although, as your show already points out, what does that mean for North Koreans versus the Americans? Another thing that came out of the Singapore meeting was a mutual commitment to, quote, reorienting the U.S.-DPRK relationship to something more friendlier. And again, very, very vague. And the third was something that actually had some follow-up, which was to return the remains of some U.S. soldiers, U.S. personnel who had been, whose remains were in North Korea. And that I think around 55 of these came back, and they're still under scientific review to try to match up DNA, et cetera. So those are some of the things that came out of the meeting. But in terms of the nuclear threat no longer existing, it's not necessarily true. The North Koreans continue to develop nuclear fuel. They have not tested nuclear devices. They have not launched nuclear missiles. Launched missiles as delivery systems for the nuclear devices. And that's significant, but I would still put North Korea as a considerable danger.
So some concrete progress there, but perhaps not as sweeping as the president indicated. But I'm hoping we can parse that definition of denuclearization a bit. You sort of mentioned it a moment ago, Professor. It may be the case that what North Korea means by denuclearization is the whole peninsula. In other words, United States, you get your nukes out of the area as well. If those are the terms, is that a tenable situation for the U.S.?
If those are the terms, it's really not tenable under normal circumstances, although with President Trump, I'm not sure what he'd be willing to say yes to, even though that does not necessarily mean that the U.S. government is fully behind it. We do know that North Koreans were ambiguous in June about denuclearization, but since then, things became clearer, and most recently in the January 1st, 2019 New Year's Day speech or address by Kim Jong-un to his own people, he made it very explicit that denuclearization requires the United States to remove all types of threats, nuclear threats, as well as other types of threats to the North Koreans. If that's the bar that he's setting, then there's really not going to be much progress. But I think in terms of Vietnam, we're going to see mostly an effort on both Kim's part and Trump's part to act like that there is progress continuing and that to keep the diplomatic doors open. I think what the North Koreans have made it clear to Washington is that they want some kinds of sanctions relief, and I expect that the U.S. government will give some lower-level sanctions relief, especially in the humanitarian realm, but not in the very significant international finance, banking, trade, et cetera, those aspects. And then in turn, the question is, what would North Korea give? And that is really not clear. I don't see the North Koreans giving up records of nuclear facilities and the accounting that many Americans in Washington have been seeking.
So I think what you're getting at there is sort of what would be the win for each side. And you mentioned sanctions relief for North Korea. So maybe let's start there. I mean, what would a win out of these talks look like for Kim Jong-un? And by the way, it's possible that just showing up is a win in a way, just for the optics of standing on another international stage with the president of the United States.
Sure. In terms of the optics, the North Koreans have won handily since June, because what the June summit meeting allowed was for Kim to become recognized as an international leader. And since June, he has been meeting with Xi Jinping of China, and other leaders, and now the Vietnamese leaders have received him very warmly when he arrived in Vietnam. This has become a new opening for Kim Jong-un personally and for the North Korean state to be visible. No one can say that it's a hermit kingdom any longer or that they are hiding, because they certainly have not been. As far as a win for North Koreans, they also are seeking some kind of a declaration to the end of the Korean War. And that is something that the Trump administration apparently is considering. And if that were to be granted in Hanoi, for North Korea, or rather for Pyongyang, for Kim, that is a big win, because it would allow him to be able to argue or make a case to his own people, especially the military, that if there is an end to the Korean War, then the rationale for the nuclear weapons program and some of the massive military buildup no longer is so strong. But of course, then the Koreans, North Koreans, will want to see some progress on the table through working-level meetings toward an actual peace agreement or a peace treaty. And that is a much more complex process. It would involve other players like South Korea, China, the United Nations potentially, and has many, many legal aspects that would involve, it would not be an easy bilateral optic moment, let's put it that way.
And if you're scratching your head, listeners, and saying, well, I thought we ended the Korean War decades and decades ago, just a reminder, the war, of course, is not raging in an active state, but symbolically this would draw a sort of formal end to the war, which has not yet been signed. In the moments we have left, Professor, just let's get to the flip side from the U.S. perspective. What would success look like for President Trump? What would be a win for him?
Well, I want to distinguish a success for President Trump versus for the U.S. government. For the U.S. government, we need to have clear, credible inventories of nuclear assets in North Korea, and some kind of a gesture that they would be open to working out a negotiated verification process over time. And those things are very sticky points for the North Koreans. A win for Trump is not necessarily the items I mentioned. A win for Trump is to come off looking like he's delivered more peace, more security in East Asia and for the United States because, as he has claimed, he has gotten North Korea to stop, to cease nuclear testing as well as lobbing its missiles. But frankly, that was a moratorium that the North Koreans initiated. It's not something that the U.S. forced on them, obviously. And Mr. Trump, and this is, you know, not a dig at him, but it's very clear from all the news that's available to us that he really wants a Nobel Prize. And so I think a win for him would be very different from a win that we really need as a government and as a people.
Well, and of course, he was almost campaigning in his State of the Union when he said that the U.S. would be at war with North Korea were he not elected. Kathy Moon, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Kathy Moon is a professor of political science and Asian studies at Wellesley College.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
The Massachusetts Division of Insurance has agreed to investigate an allegation that faulty car appraisals by a widely used company are routinely costing drivers hundreds or even thousands of dollars in claims on totaled and stolen vehicles. The decision to investigate was not public until WBUR reported it last week. The probe was prompted by a complaint about Chicago-based CCC Information Services. Many leading insurance companies here in Massachusetts and in other states hire CCC to estimate what totaled cars were worth before being wrecked or stolen. Insurers then use the appraisals to help determine how much money to pay policyholders to cover the costs of replacement cars. The complaint was filed by Source One Financial Corporation, a Norwell auto lender. Michael Parsons is Source One's chief financial officer and is here to talk about what his firm is alleging. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Thank you, Cal.
So let me just begin by explaining how these appraisals from CCC are supposed to work, and then you can tell me where you believe things are going wrong. So when an insurance company determines that a car is a total loss, it brings in CCC, and the company searches dealer inventories for used vehicles of the same make, model, and year, and the prices of those used cars become reference points. But CCC adjusts the prices up or down, weighing factors like whether the totaled car had more miles or wear and tear. It sounds like a good process, Mike. So where do you believe the problem lies?
The determination of what the purchase price is can't reasonably be done by the field representatives of CCC. What's occurring is they hire a young person here in the Boston marketplace. They're far away from their home offices, which are back in New Jersey. And this individual is supposed to walk into a car dealership and ask that car dealership, what is the best price you'll give me for that car, with no intent of buying it. There isn't a car dealership in eastern Massachusetts that's going to give you their best price on a car when you're just walking in and trying to determine information.
I see. So there's one part of it is whether the price that you get for the comparable vehicle is a reliable reference point. But then on top of that, as I mentioned, there's an adjustment of that price up or down, and you take issue with those condition adjustments as well.
Oh, most assuredly. What's occurring in the condition adjustments up and down is every single car at every single dealership is deemed to be showroom ready, new car. Every single car that the consumer has that they've totaled, that they've wrecked, can at best be normal wear and tear. That's a 10% decrease in the value of the car, an automatic 10% decrease. And if there are other condition reports that are noted, such as worn tires, worn paint, chips, small dings and scratches, then those deductions are on top of that initial 10% decrease. At Source One, we actually had an example of a car that was stolen, not recovered, in which CCC took $5,000 worth of condition adjustments for things such as burn marks in the seats, torn headliner, brown spots in the transmission fluid, when they had never seen the subject vehicle. I have hundreds of these reports that I've looked at, and never once have I seen where valuation report produced by CCC appeared to be true or correct.
So what's your firm's stake in all of this? I mean, when we first met for the story some months ago, you were very upfront in disclosing to me that Source One had entered a consent agreement with the Division of Banks a few years ago and paid a fine after the agency alleged overcharging by some customers. Source One admitted no wrongdoing, but you pointed out to me that state regulators might wonder about your motives and wonder whether you were really trying to blow the whistle and protect consumers here.
I'm protecting consumers and myself. What's occurring here is my consumers have car loans. And those car loans are not being paid off when the car is totaled because the insurance is shorting the consumer in between $1,500 and $3,000 on average. There's no reason for me to try and collect $1,500 from a person when the insurance company really owes the money. And what they're doing is they're standing behind a faulty or fraudulent market valuation report.
So you could chase John and Sally for the difference, but you'd rather go after the big guys.
Yes. The consumer deserves what they paid for. This isn't someone who didn't have insurance. This is someone who had insurance, paid everything they were supposed to do, and they're not being treated fairly by their insurance company.
I want to note that the Division of Insurance, CCC, and multiple insurance companies all declined my interview requests, but I did catch up with Louisiana attorney J.R. Whaley. He's representing the plaintiff in a federal lawsuit against an insurance company that uses CCC appraisals. He talked a little bit about how CCC's estimates stack up against numbers from the National Automobile Dealers Association, and then he tried to channel the insurance company's arguments.
What we have seen is that the valuations are typically lower than what the NADA would call for. And the defense that, you know, the insurance companies say is that, well, you know, those electronic databases are better and they are more real time because NADA is regional or NADA is quarterly or what have you.
So what about that defense, Mike? I mean, the National Automobile Dealers Association tracks used car sales data, and insurers could, in theory, just go by the book. But doesn't that fail to account for all the dings and coffee spills on a particular vehicle?
No, it doesn't. The average used car is the average used car. NADA is a nationwide system. It's been in place for almost 100 years. It works, and it works well. CCC is a selective book. They're choosing the lowest price vehicles to put into their report. They're never choosing the highest price car. This is a privately held company. They conduct their own market investigations. They aren't subject to review. It's just a really sad situation for a consumer.
And the NADA database is public, I should point out.
So. And mind you, for your car, it's free. You can pull down its value anytime you want.
So in the course of reporting this story, Mike, you turned over a lot of documents to WBUR, including emails with the Division of Insurance. I'm sure they were thrilled by that. But why did you do that instead of just letting the process play out quietly behind closed doors? I mean, what are you hoping to accomplish by going public?
What I'd really hope to accomplish is a real investigation of CC1 and the insurance companies in Massachusetts by the Division of Insurance. The Division of Insurance has not cited a major insurance company in the automobile industry in forever. When I file complaints with the Division of Insurance, and I shared the email with you, the response I've got is, we have 1,400 complaints. We're going to stick this one on top. Well, the consumer needs their car. They need it in the next 30 days. The idea that a consumer would file a complaint regarding the market value of their car because they disagree with it, and it gets thrown on top of a pile of complaints 1,400 items deep, puts them in a totally untenable situation. And it's really not fair that the Division of Insurance seems to be conducting a very quiet, very non-public investigation here. They won't even tell me who at the Division of Insurance is conducting the investigation. They've asked me for information, which I've delivered some almost a year ago now, and I've gotten no real response from the division. Finally, everyone should be aware, if they want to be aware, that the Massachusetts Division of Insurance has one of the worst rankings of any insurance division in the country. It's an F, or I believe it was just moved to upgraded to a D minus. That's just sad, and it needs to be fixed. I'm fighting for money, there's no question, but I'm also fighting for consumers' money as well. And consumers should be aware that when they get that first offer from the insurance company, and it's a 16-page long document, and it looks awfully official, maybe they should look at it and say, maybe this is not the truth, and take a few minutes and read it and understand it.
Well, and now that the investigation is public, we'll all be watching and seeing what the Division of Insurance does. That's Michael Parsons, Chief Financial Officer of Source One Financial in Norwell. Mike, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Coming up, how 26-year-old rapper Cousin Stiz became a hometown hero in Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Cousin Stiz, a 26-year-old from Dorchester. He's an award-winning rapper and something of a hometown hero in Boston. But long before he would sell out concert venues or become affiliated with an NBA team, Stiz was just a kid from the neighborhood. WBUR's Nico Emack has the story.
Stiz met many of the friends he has today playing football and basketball. These friends quickly became family. And together, they learned how to navigate the neighborhood.
Sports has always been it, like, especially being in Boston, like, all the championships and stuff like that, you know what I'm saying? It kind of goes hand in hand.
Stiz remembers the championships, the parades, and even some heartbreak.
What was it, the 03 playoffs when we lost? The Celtics lost? I shed a tear that year when we lost in the playoffs. And that's when I knew, like, dang, I'm a Boston sports fan. Like, my mom couldn't believe how heartbroken I was about it. Like, it was funny at first, and then she seen how really sad I was, and then it got real sad in the house.
The first time he ever went to a game at the TD Garden, Stiz sat in the nosebleeds with the local Boys and Girls Club. The Celtics lost that night, but he was just excited to be a part of the atmosphere.
I just remember those, the chants. Like, I don't remember the music that they play.
Years later, his love of sports and music would collide in a way many only dream about. Stiz got a call from the Celtics, offering him a job for the 2018-2019 season. Cousin Stiz was born Steven Goss. His friends gave him his nickname.
So he was just like, bro, we can't be calling you Steven. Like, and that's pretty much just where it came from. Like, boom, Stizzy.
He says he owes everything to Dorchester.
Everything, man. The way I walk, the way I talk, the way I act, the way I think, the way I react, you know, it's all my neighborhood.
Of Boston's 23 neighborhoods, Dorchester is the largest and most diverse.
You know, so I got a whole bunch of everything, but I ain't grew up in the best neighborhood, you know. Just because it was diverse doesn't mean, you know, that it was always good.
Crime, poverty, drugs, and death were the norm where Stiz grew up. But he knew there was more to life than that.
Something I always knew. It's like, this wasn't it. Like, the hood wasn't it for me, you know what I'm saying?
Stiz says he had a great support system of friends and family. But the older he got, the harder it became to avoid the negative influences in his life.
That was like around the time like I started losing friends and stuff like that, you know what I'm saying? I was kind of acting out.
And that's when his mom gave him a choice.
Either go into the military or like, goddamn, we gonna ship you out here.
Out here meant going to high school in the suburbs, an hour outside of Boston, away from his friends, away from trouble. And that's what he did.
I went to Reading Memorial High School in Reading, Mass.
Stiz enrolled in the METCO program. The METCO program started in 1966 after parents of black students boycotted segregation in the Boston public school system. Today, nearly 38 suburban school districts offer enrollment to inner-city kids who are looking for alternatives to their local schools.
It was a culture shock, man. Like, before that, I only knew what I knew. I only knew about going to school with kids that look like me, act like me, you know? And going out there was completely different. It gave me a head start to life, almost, in a way.
To get to school on time, Stiz would have to wake up at 5:40 in the morning. His father, who worked construction, would often be his alarm clock. From there, Stiz would hop on a special bus. It took 90 minutes to get from the city to the suburbs. Every now and then, he would catch a nap. Sometimes he would listen to music. Most times, he would just think.
And then I go to school, and like I see like how things are so much different, how people are living so much differently, you know, how what money could really do, you know, and then I go back to the hood at 3 o'clock.
The first couple of times Stiz missed the METCO bus, his mom let him off easy. But after his sophomore year, she tightened the reins. That meant if Stiz missed the bus, he'd have to take public transportation to get to school. A ride that would have taken 90 minutes would stretch on for hours.
Catch the bus, ride it all the way to the train station. If you get on the red line, you got to take the red line to downtown crossing. You got to take the daggone orange line to the North Station. You get off, then I got to catch that purple line train all the way to Reading.
The commute was a nightmare.
You got some time on your hands, dog. You got some time to, like, really do something, you know what I'm saying? So, like, one day I just, you know, decided to write something over what was it? It was the Lil Wayne beat. I think it was Throwing the Bag, yep, on the No Ceilings mixtape. No Ceilings, baby. And that was the first one. Like, that was the first one.
For years, Stiz didn't tell his friends he was writing, let alone rapping. And when he finally did tell them, he didn't get the reaction he expected.
My homies told me I was trash until I got good. But that's what real friends are for. My real friends was like, bro, no. But I ended up getting good. And then they was like, actually, you got something. You might actually got something going for you. So you should probably keep going, bro. And then it completely switched. And it was like, bet, we rocking 100% with it.
In June of 2015, Stiz released Suffolk County, his debut mixtape.
Who you know from out here? Your name ain't ringing no bells, boy. Who you know from out here?
It dealt with a wide variety of themes, but in particular, loss. You know, what's your relationship like with death?
Pretty familiar. I'm too familiar for my liking. It happens, you know, more frequently than I would like it to around me.
Stiz was in his early 20s when his friend Damone Clark was diagnosed with a rare form of bone cancer.
F cancer. Forever, you know what I'm saying? But, dog, like, he was a G, man. He took it better than we did. Like, he knew what it was, and he was just a gangster about it, man. He told us, like, man, we better not cry about it, and we got to make sure everything, you know, we moving how we supposed to when he's gone. And I just, you know, I tried to.
Damone passed away in January of 2016, just days after his 17th birthday.
He was just a bright light. Like, he was a funny kid. Like, he was just a light, man. Like, for real, for real. I wish everybody could have met him. He was just a good kid with a good heart, for real.
Stiz named his second mixtape Monda after Damone and rededicated himself to his music. In July of 2017, Stiz released his first studio album. He became more than just a Boston rapper. His music began popping up on soundtracks and in TV shows. Then, in the fall of 2018, he got a call from the Boston Celtics, asking him to be the official voice of the 2018-2019 season. In his new role, he provides voiceover for hype videos pushed out on social media.
From game 1 to game 82 and beyond,
Rest well, because tomorrow, we rise.
Stiz doesn't remember what music was playing at his first Celtics game, but he does remember the first time he heard his own music at the TD Garden. He had just finished playing a set at the Boston Calling Music Festival.
When I got there, I was already on 10 rowdiness, and then, like, when I heard my joint, it was big lit.
Dirty bands came from dirty work. Dirty bands that make their feelings hurt.
I try not to think about things too much, but that was huge. Like, you know, it felt like I almost was in the league, but I wasn't in the league, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's really what it felt like. Like, dang, I made it, like, to the league.
Then something really crazy happened. In week 6 of the NFL season, the New England Patriots beat the Kansas City Chiefs 43-40. And Tom Brady posted a victory video on Instagram with Stiz's music playing in the background.
5-2, that's the goal. Chicago next. Gonna need everybody. Gronk, you can line up however you want and you keep stiff-arming people like that. Let's go! My kids are sleeping.
Yeah, I put the drink in the headlock.
I can't even begin to describe my love for Tom Brady. So to see somebody like that, you know what I'm saying, for them to put me up on their page and, you know, give me that look, it's just like, man, I don't know. To see stuff like that just lets me know I'm in the right direction.
Cousin Stiz lives in L.A. now, almost 3,000 miles away from Dorchester. He knows he's lucky to have made it this far, but he hasn't forgotten about the people back home.
I want people to keep going, because there's a way, dog. Like, if I could do it, anybody could do it.
Hey, I can't believe that we did it.
That report comes to us from WBUR's Nico Emack. It originally aired on Only a Game. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hopti. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.